And yes, just to say, the image here at the front, I think, the one that's got the colours around it, that is the six-syllable mantra that was mentioned in the story, the Om Mani Padme Hum. So just usually when you chant a mantra, you visualise it in your mind going round and round. So there's a syllable in the middle and then the other syllables are sort of going round and round it. So that's, and Om Mani Padme Hum means... it means something like the jewel in the heart of the lotus. So it's kind of a poetic, mysterious phrase. And sometimes, like in this form of Avalokiteshvara, he's got his hands in this mudra, which is also the mudra, the gesture that we use when we salute the shrine. And what that is, it looks a little bit like a praying gesture, but it's actually sort of imagining that you're holding the jewel of enlightenment in your hands. So he's holding that to his heart, the jewel of enlightenment. So in the mantra, the jewel in the heart of the lotus means the jewel of enlightenment, which is in our hearts somewhere already. And it needs to be... So one way of thinking... It's another way of thinking of enlightenment is you just need to reveal it. It's already there inside of us. And we need to just get rid of the rubbish that's covering it up and it will be revealed. So there's many different ways of... thinking of enlightenment. Anyway, I better start. So I'm going to talk just for about maybe 10-15 minutes, just talking a little bit more about what the Bodhisattva ideal, and then hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for questions and discussion, and then we end, I always like to end with a bit of just sitting, and maybe we'll actually chant the six-syllable mantra at the end, yeah? So a lot of what I'm going to say comes from this book, which I think might be in the bookshop. It's called The Bodhisattva Ideal. It is one of Sangharakshita's books. And it's a book that's based on some lectures he gave, which you can also listen to on Free Buddhist Audio about the Bodhisattva Ideal. It's 8 lectures, quite a long series of lectures, which shows how important this particular concept, this particular ideal, was to him. These lectures have been edited into this book, and that would be, I mean, for me, that would be one of my desert island books, actually. It's the ideas in this book, they're quite profound ideas, but he has a very lucid way of explaining them, and for me, they have really completely changed my way of looking at life and the world. I remember when I was doing Mitra study, which is many years ago, it just blew my mind. I'd never heard anything like it before, and it really is very extraordinary. So, a bit of personal background. I mean, Sangharakshita, when he lived in India, when he was in his 20s, he had 8 different teachers. And one of his teachers was... looked like this when he was young, was called Dado Rinpoche. He had quite a few Tibetan teachers. And Dado Rinpoche was quite special amongst Sangharakshita's teachers in that both Sangharakshita and everybody else who you come across who has met this man, he died in in the 90s, actually, so he's been dead for some time now. But everybody who met him seemed to really think he was actually a living bodhisattva. That he was really sort of spontaneously just pouring himself into the world. He was very, very kind. You sort of were in his presence and you just felt like he had something really extraordinary about him. So one of the reasons why Sangharakshita was so inspired by the story of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara and the Bodhisattva ideal was because of this teacher of his who had that as his main practice and actually said to him that he was trying to emulate Avalokiteshvara. In his life, he wasn't doing very well, he thought, but that's what he was trying to do. I don't know, some of you might have been here when Amlanadi a few weeks ago gave a talk about spiritual friendship, and she was quoting one of the main slogan of this teacher of Dado Rinpoche, which is cherish the doctrine, live united, radiate love. So in a way, if you think about them, by cherish the doctrine, he meant cherish the Dharma, you know, cherish the Buddhist teachings, live united, radiate love. So if you could do those 3 things, probably the world would be a better place. And he was a very high lama. So in Tibetan, in his culture,
He was a reincarnation, you know, he was seen as a reincarnation of a very highly achieved being. He was actually at one point the abbot of the Tibetan monastery in Bodh Gaya, the seat of the Buddha's enlightenment. So he was, in terms of status and prestige, he was a very high up lama. But what he ended up doing was he moved to this little town of Kalimpong in the hills, which is where Sangharakshita ended up for 12 years, and just founded a school for refugee children. And he ran this school for about 30 years and said that's what he was doing. He was wanting to do something useful. That's what needed to be done. And so he was doing that. And people couldn't believe it. The Tibetans, you know, thinking, what is this high lama doing, like running the school? And still, I've visited Kalimpong a few times, and there are people living in Kalimpong who, Tibetan refugees from the previous generation, who still remember him. And they would tell you, we saw him washing the children's clothes, you know, which is unheard of for like a lama of high status. So he was just this very humble man who people, you know, still remember as incredibly inspiring. So he was one of Sangharakshita's teachers. And he taught Sangharakshita about Avalokiteshvara and said he was emulating his example. So also what he was exemplifying, I suppose, this teacher, is a similar thing to what the Buddha is exemplifying, is that as well as the teachings, you know, the Dharma, actually your way of life and what you exemplify, how you live your life, is as important as the teaching. Sort of really walking the talk, doing what you're actually teaching is as important, and he seems to have really been doing that. So I'll just go through a few things that struck me when I was hearing and reading this book of the Bodhisattva Ideal and see if it resonates with you in some way. So one of the things Sangharakshita said about it was, to consider this topic is to place one's hand on the very heart of Buddhism and feel the beating of that heart, which I thought was really very evocative. And that the Bodhisattva embodies the compassion aspect of enlightenment. So a Bodhisattva, as I said before, is an enlightened being who chooses to stay or return to the world until all living beings are led to liberation from suffering. And one way, Sangharakshita was explaining it, he was saying that one could think of there being sort of two circles. There's one great big circle, which is our words when we're teaching, for example. And then there's a tiny circle, which is our being. And our aim is to really make those two circles be the same. You know, so our being reflecting our words and our teachings. That's the Bodhisattva ideal, really. And according to the Bodhisattva ideal, there can be no spiritual development without consideration for others. And there can be no true altruism without a basis in one's own spiritual development. So it's just as important as each other. As we develop our minds, quite naturally, we will also want to go outwards, helping others. So the Bodhisattva vow is really what it's saying. One translation of it is, I place no limit on what I am prepared to do for other living beings when the time is ripe and I am ready. So that is really expressing both. You know, so you have to be ready. You have to really feel genuinely ready for internally to do that, to say that. Ready to transcend sort of the limitations of your ego. And that has to be genuine. Otherwise, like Avalokiteshvara, you'll fall apart. You'll break down. You won't be able to sustain it. So it really needs a big faith in the interconnectedness of all living beings, you know, that we're not separate, that we're really interconnected with everything that lives. And he was saying that the bodhicitta is the eruption into our being of something transcendental, of something totally different from our ordinary experience. So some symbols for the bodhicitta, or for the heart of enlightenment, are the full moon, are beams of intersecting rainbow light. So you could think of it like that. It's a reflection. It's something. It's an energy in the universe that we can tap into. So Sangharakshita in his teachings was talking about an ethical universe, which is quite an interesting concept. So it's like, there is this idea that the jewel of enlightenment is already in our hearts and it just needs to be revealed by clearing away all the rubbish. And then when it's revealed, it can sort of tune into a kind of spirit in the universe, which is naturally ethical and spontaneous, like a bodhisattva. So then individually, we can tune into that wider spirit. And that also, when you look at the figure of Avalokiteshvara and you think of Sangharakshita's idea of the whole Sangha being that being, you know, collectively, if more than one of us, if say this room full of people are all aspiring to see things as they really are, to develop our minds, and then we naturally out of that want to help other beings and want to do something different and want to do less harm, then that is quite a force in the world. And then that is supported by actually a force, an ethical force that operates in the universe that we can then tune into. One more quote from the book, which I think is my favourite quote of all times. It's to do with this idea that the bodhicitta, the heart of enlightenment, more often arises communally rather than individually. So Sangharakshita was saying, if one's inner experience finds a collective expression in some kind of spiritual movement, one could think of that movement as having a dream life or a mythic life of its own. Perhaps it does have an existence on another level. Indeed, if it didn't, if it was merely an organization on the material plane, it would wither away very quickly. It needs to have very deep roots in the sky. So that's another quite evocative image, isn't it? Roots in the sky. So Avalokiteshvara, on becoming enlightened himself, he was immediately moved to vow to stay in the world until all living beings were liberated from suffering. So this altruistic energy is said to arise spontaneously, and it did so for the Buddha as well, because the Buddha, when he was enlightened, even though he thought it would be difficult, but his mind very quickly turned to, how can I communicate this? How can I share this with beings so that they can realize the same? And he said that everything that exists is reflected in the depth of the enlightened mind, but the enlightened mind is not affected by whatever is reflected in it. Which is quite interesting, like a hologram. And that the enlightened person is like a clear window through which the light of reality shines almost undistorted. So it's like a crystal or a diamond which concentrates and reflects the light. So all of those images are like, you know, individually we can sort of get in touch with something inside our hearts which then reflects what's outside, or the inside and the outside become connected and no longer separate. It's like a golden thread, he said. So there's something in the depths of our own being which all the time connects us with reality, like a kind of golden thread, which although it might be very thin, it's always there. And then we can make it stronger and make it brighter by connecting, sort of trying to connect with that spirit in the universe. We can do it through art, we can do it through nature, we can do it through various, we can do it through meditation, through really looking inside ourselves. So it's various methods we can use to connect more with it. So just to end, I'll just read you a sort of longer quote from this book, which kind of sums up really the bodhisattva's path. So if you make the bodhisattva vow, if you vow that you sort of, you know, remain in the world until all beings, living beings, are liberated, this is kind of the path that you would be on. It's a very beautiful passage, I think. That even without going into the traditional details too closely, it isn't difficult to understand how the bodhicitta might arise in dependence on these four factors. Through recollecting the Buddha, we become convinced that enlightenment is possible. They have gained enlightenment. Why shouldn't we gain it too? The Buddhas, he means. Through this kind of reflection, energy and vigour is stirred up. Then, through seeing the faults of conditioned existence, seeing that it's impermanent, basically unsatisfactory, and not ultimately real, we become detached from the world. The trend, the stream of our existence begins to flow in the direction of the unconditioned. Next, through observing the suffering of sentient beings, whether in imagination or in actual fact, compassion arises. We don't think only of our own liberation. We want to help others too. Then, by contemplating the virtues of the Buddhas, their purity, their peacefulness, their wisdom, their love, we gradually become assimilated to them and approach the goal of enlightenment. As these four, energy, detachment, compassion, and becoming one, as it were, with the Buddhas, start to coalesce within our hearts, the bodhicitta arises, the awakening of the heart is achieved, a bodhisattva is born.